Welcome to the show. We'll have interesting dialogue. Hi, this is Jane Hoffman. Good evening, this is Jane Hoffman. Tonight's show is going to revolve around what the purpose for the American government is worldwide. I'm going to read an excerpt from Henry Kissinger's book, Diplomacy. We're also going to be discussing China scolding Trump on Twitter. They have about three major websites of state-run media, which is I find it rather embarrassing that a major world power has to scold our president on social media. The New World Order Reconsidered by Henry Kissinger, Chapter 31, the book Diplomacy. By the beginning of the last decade of the 20th century, Wilsonianism seems triumphant. The communist ideological and the Soviet geopolitical changes had been overcome simultaneously. The objective of moral opposition to communism had merged with the geopolitical task of resisting Soviet expansionism. No wonder that President Bush proclaimed his hope for a new world order in classically Wilsonian terms. We have a vision of a new partnership of nations that transcends the Cold War, a partnership based on consultation, cooperation, and collective action, especially through international and regional organizations. A partnership united by principle and the rule of law and supported by an equitable sharing of both cost and commitment. A partnership whose goals are to increase democracy, increase prosperity, increase the peace, and reduce arms. Bush's Democratic successor, President Bill Clinton, expressed America's goals in very similar terms, expounding on the theme of enlarging democracy. In a new era of peril and opportunity, our overriding purpose must be to expand and strengthen the world community of market-based democracies. During the Cold War, we sought to contain a threat of survival of free institutions. Now we seek to enlarge the circle of nations that live under those free institutions. For our dream is a day of when the opinions and energies of every person in the world will be given full expression in a world of thriving democracies that cooperate with each other and live in peace. Well, technically, now this is me talking, that did not happen. There are segments of the earth that became more prosperous, but the ideological constraint of ISIS and the breakdown of the Middle Eastern culture and the 11 governments that failed in 2011 were kind of like the edge of the ice age where the melting occurred, and there has been little recovery in the process of improving worldwide unity because of that constraint. Now, places like Germany and Poland have continued to prosper and establish long-term successful economies. Places like America have offered free or subsidized college to students, but it hasn't promoted successful jobs in business except for the field of medicine. And a lot of people are still trapped in service industry jobs and things of that nature. I'm going to cut back to the book again after I play this song. I'm waiting for my co-host to call in. Every day, it seems, Americans awaken to a crisis signifying a world out of control. In Europe, our allies and partners are coping with Russian aggression, ranging from cyber attacks and energy coercion to conventional military might and a renewed emphasis on nuclear weapons. At the same time, Europe grapples with the world's most significant migration crisis since World War II. In Asia, satellite images of China's aggressive island-building activities are widely viewed as corroborating that nations designed to control the air and sea space far from its shores. Meanwhile, North Korea's Kim Jong-un continues his family legacy of dangerous provocations and nuclear ambitions. As significant as the security situation is in these two regions, no area of the world is in greater tumult than the Middle East. I just mentioned that. From the destabilizing role of Iran to the chaos of Libya to the complete destruction of Syria and its implications for Iraq, Jordan, Turkey, and beyond, the upheaval appears endless. Not to mention the 39 people who died last week in Turkey. The international system is shifting in ways not fully understood. Critics have pointed out the Obama administration's failure to articulate its vision for the U.S. role in the world, evolving along so many dimensions. Yet the administration is not alone. No significant historian, analyst, or politician has done so either, including the administration's harshest critics. Policymakers should keep three factors in mind when devising such a vision. The first key factor shaping the role of the United States today is the paradox of enduring superpower status combined with lessening global influence. I do want to mention that because after Russia collapsed, we weren't seen as the world. I see it on the air, John. I'll bring it in a second. After Russia collapsed, supposedly in 1989, but I call it that they just restructured. They didn't really collapse, except for they lost some economic ground with the fall of the Berlin Curtain. Visionary unipolar superpower, but really we can only stretch our octopus so far, and we can't solve every world crisis or remedy it. And I don't think Obama should be given that much credit for not solving serious problems. In fact, we've intervened on the ground and tried to take more control of ISIS. There would be more death and more military destruction. Even with Russia's single-handed involvement in Syria, it's really only produced worse chaos for those poor residents of all those major cities like Aleppo, and pretty much decimated the whole region. Now, Europe has taken the backhand of that fallout by taking in refugees, and the world is that question right now. And I just want to inform John that I want to read one more clip on the book so you have an idea what I've been talking about. I read a quote from George Bush, the senior George Bush, about his vision of the New World. And then Bill Clinton, who followed him. And then I'm going to read this last paragraph. For the third time in this century, America has proclaimed its intention to build a new world order by employing its domestic values to the world at large. And for the third time, America spent its power over the international stage. In 1918, Woodrow Wilson overshadowed the Paris Peace Conference, towards the end of the Second World War, Franklin Roosevelt and Truman tend to be in a position to recast the entire globe on the American model. The end of the Cold War produced a greater temptation to recast the international environment in America's image. Wilson has been constrained by isolation at home. The Truman came up against Stalin
the globe.
Yet power has become more diffuse, and the issues to which military force is relevant have diminished. Victory in the Cold War has propelled America into a world which bears much similarities to the European state system of the 18th and 19th centuries, and to practices which American statesmen and thinkers have consistently questioned. The absence of both an overriding ideological or strategic threat frees nations to pursue foreign policies based on increasing their immediate national interests. In an international system characterized by powers and a multiplicity of smaller states, order will have to emerge, but as it did in past centuries, from a reconciliation and balancing of competing national interests. And I see that on a smaller scale in Liberia. Lauren's uncle is one of the leading technology advisors in bringing the internet to Liberia, and they're still a nation in progress. They have a long way to go to get on a grand scale and be part of the competitive economy. With that, I'll bring John in. Hi, John.
Greetings, Janessa Hoffman. How are you?
Blog Talk Radio is a giant dinosaur that cannot die.
I see. By the way, for the first 5 minutes or so that I was listening to you, the sound was very muffled. I don't know if that was just my phone, but the last 3 minutes or so, I could hear everything you were saying. And before then, it was like you were in a bubble on my end. So I don't know if that's when you check your archives, if that will be the sound quality. You might double check it because I could not hear.
Sometimes if my phone isn't on speaker, I have a cheaper model of an AT&T phone. And if I don't have it on speaker, it comes out muffled sometimes.
Of all the shows, I think about 90% of the time, 95% of the time, I can hear you, you know, pretty clear. And this is the first time in a long time. And it's just for, like I say, the first 5 or 8 minutes I was on, I was listening. And so it was hard to tell what the subject was. And then the last 3 minutes, it was coming through really clear.
I think it's because after I played your song, you know, I read an article from the Huffington Post about what America's role in the world is and their paradox of an enduring superpower status. But the reason it transitioned into better hearing is because I put it on speaker. So let me just make it clear. We can talk about Donald Trump until Don gets on the air. But before we do that, because China poo-pooed Trump today on Twitter regarding his Twitter behavior. But before we do that, can I read you a quote by George Bush about the New World Order?
Oh, go for it.
Okay, so President Bush tried to proclaim his hope for the New World in the way that Woodrow Wilson did, kind of like half isolation but half helping hand. So I'll just read it. We have a vision of a new partnership of nations that transcends the Cold War, a partnership based on consultation, cooperation, and collective action, especially through international and regional organizations. I think he means NGOs, non-government. A partnership united by principle and the rule of law and supported by an equitable sharing of both cost and commitment. A partnership whose goals are to increase democracy, prosperity, increase the peace, and reduce arms. Well, okay, that was probably in 1989, and obviously, let's see, 90, oh, about 30 years later, do you think that's happened?
You know, it in some ways, I think it has. What's interesting to me is that that America is an amazing country. Now you think about all the inventions we have in the world. You know, think about planes, radios, TVs, satellites. A lot of stuff, as far as I understand, it's American in creation and in you know, making it happen. And it's just an amazing thing about this country that we have not only a freedom to pursue what we want, but we also have a faith system for most of the country, or at least that was somewhat of a basis behind the pillars of what this country stands for. And obviously there's been a lot of good and a lot of bad that's come through it, but on the planet, I don't think, in looking at other countries, other nations, I don't think we've gotten so many inventions, so many technologies, so many contributions to the planet as through America, as well as the influence that we've had in trying to keep peace, trying to keep freedom for people. Can you think of another country that has more contributions to the world, our current world?
I think I don't want to overlook every country, but like, for example, remember that movie about the Enigma, that Enigma code, where British uh-huh. cracked the secret codes of the Germans in World War II, and then in World War I and World War II, America used American Indian language to deceive the Japanese, mainly in World War II. Let me get my bearings straight. Can you talk a minute while I blow my nose? I'm real sorry.
Oh, sure. Not a problem. Yeah, I mean, it just seems to me that this country is an amazing, creative, powerful influence on the planet. And I think what's really wonderful is when there's a spiritual connection, a spiritual basis, then good things happen. I think the more we stray from a spiritual foundation, the problem is technology, it's neither good nor bad. It's neutral. It's who's using it. You know, you can use fire to make food. You can use it as a flamethrower to kill people with it. It's neither, you know, has a will of its own. It's the will of the person using it. So I think that's what's great about this country. I think in Russia, in other places, China, they don't believe in God. They try to outlaw God. So there's certain morality that they can cross. They can kill and murder people. And not that we don't kill and murder people too, but we do try to rebuild countries. We do try to...
I think the call got dropped, and what he said was significant, and he will be calling in another minute. I do think other countries have, we can't see it from our perspective all the time, but there's other countries in the world like Germany and Poland. Just a second. I pulled you back in, John.
Yay.
I agree with what you said. I don't want to America, okay, we live in America, and this is the center of our consciousness. I know that around the world, you know, our culture, our government was built on a European model. Places like Germany and Poland have done a lot of wonderful inventions in the last 30 years regarding computer advancement. I'm trying to look the figure up now. I do think we have a lot of freedom. Can I just explain? We have a lot of possibilities here to develop. If you have the money and the investment, then you can do that.
Right.
I don't want to just only accolade America without, like, for example, Japan went through a stage in the 1980s where Everybody was buying their cars and buying their television sets. Now it seems like it's gone back to some American of inventions. Like,
right,
do you know who makes the TV Vizio?
Other countries have made revisions and refinements, but I'm saying, who invented the car? America. Who invented planes? America. Who invented computers? America. It's one thing to refine something. It's another thing to birth it, to make it happen, to visualize it. And I'm not saying other countries are incapable. I'm just saying the major stuff, you know, put a man on the moon, it's America. I mean, I think we kind of lost that faith or that.
Well, actually,
that
Russia was the first one to put someone into space in the 50s.
Into space, I understand, but were they the first to land on the moon?
I don't know. I think we were.
Right, Neil Armstrong.
What are you trying to say in parallel to what I was mentioning about America and what their place in the world as far as diplomatic relations? Because obviously, as a superpower, we can't solve every problem. We can't
take
Angela Merkel's problem of integrating 1 million Syrians, or we can't fix Aleppo's devastation of an entire city. So what can we do?
I think we can be great again. I think we can go to our values of God and of faith and of the freedom to pursue your happiness, to have liberty, to have justice. You know, and it doesn't mean justice is immediate, you know, as in the case of African Americans, as in the case of Indians and other cultures, but justice inevitably. As Martin Luther King said, you know, we will overcome, and I have a dream. I think that's the beauty of America. And I mean, I know you want to rally around your socialist friends, the cosmonauts that went into space. I understand that. But I'm just saying, and you should be proud of your communist friends. But I'm just saying, I'm an American. I love being an American. And are there other places to go? Yeah, but they weren't necessarily in Japanese culture. They wouldn't teach me about Jesus Christ, or in China or Russia or in India or in most of the Middle East. I would not know salvation of Jesus as Lord and Savior. So for me, that's important. Now, for other people, it's not that important. They don't believe that. And I get that. It's a faith call, but I'm very – I found salvation.
Our countries that are Christian, to tell you the truth, Mexico and South America have more Christians than we do proportionally. They have 95% of probably not places like Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro, but all of South America. We're not the only place in the world that has Christians. And Korea has a huge Christian population.
They have missionaries. They don't send out missionaries. They don't share the gospel. They're too poor
Koreans
to help other
people. Koreans do.
Well,
there's thousands of Korean missionaries in Los Angeles.
God bless them. But what I'm saying is they come to America. You know, half of Korea is – you're talking a country. How big is Korea?
I don't know how many people live in Korea. Probably around 5 to 10 million.
Million, and we're talking a country of 300 million that goes into every nation and shares gospel, shares food, shares, you know, has sends missionaries. I'm not saying Korea isn't important. I'm just saying in comparison, I don't think you're going to find the same. And how long has Korea been a force? The last 20 years, maybe, or so? We're talking a country that's been here for centuries.
Can I interrupt the broadcast? I was way off on the population, and I'm embarrassed. South Korea has 50.2 million people, and North Korea has 24 million. But I did read an article a few years ago about how a lot of countries around the world are now sending missionaries to America because they see us as benign and materialistic and self-centered. So,
right, and when did that process start happening?
I mentioned that is one of the most powerful families from South Korea go to my church. The Cho, C-H-O-E.
And when did that process start happening? About the last 20, 25, 30 years, right? When did that start happening? Well, in about 50 years ago, we outlawed God in the schools. In the 70s, about 45 years ago, we started getting strong into women's rights and kind of the breakdown of the family. And our culture has slipped. It has. And that's why they send missionaries over here. But they still send their kids. I can tell you at our church, you know, they send the kids over here to America so they can be educated and so they can succeed. You don't see Americans going to Korea.
Iranians and Saudi Arabians send their kids to America to be educated.
Right.
So
that's a come up.
Can I read
the
quote, please?
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't want to turn the show back on the domestic coin, because we were talking about relationships in the world, how we are handling world crises as a nation, and there
right.
are two facts I want to bring up, and then I'll allow you to you can comment, but I want to get the facts out there if you're questioning things. It says the Center for the Study of Global Christianity calculates the Christians sent out approximately 400,000 international missionaries in 2010. Of the 10 countries sending the most missionaries in the world in 2010 was Brazil, South Korea, and India. Other notable missionary centers included South Africa, the Philippines, Mexico, China, Colombia, and Nigeria. The United States still tops the chart in total missionaries, sending 127,000 in 2010 compared to 34,000 by number two ranked Brazil. Now, I do want to mention one thing. The Mormons in the United States, they fan out and send their people to all 50 states within the United States. So it's U.S. missionaries sending out missionaries to U.S. citizens. In other words, they don't cross international borders. So we have to keep in mind all those kind of people, too, like the Jehovah Witnesses who go door-to-door and people like that. After you're done commenting, I want to make I want to quote something about the Polish computer industry, too, if you don't mind.
Oh, go for it.
So go ahead with your next comment. By the way, I talked to Don, and he was supposed to call the show, but he's doing his last hour of Uber driving. So go ahead with your next comment.
Well, I love this country. I don't know. How do you feel about this country? Do you love being American? Are you excited about America? Were you excited about America the last 8 years, and then you're not excited today because of Donald Trump?
How I look at America is kind of different than probably you, because I spent 5 years in the graduate program in political science and then 2 years in the teacher program. So in the 80s and 90s, I was a writer. Like, I worked on novels, plays, and poems. So my vision of the world was always co-opted by what I saw and what I observed. I would say that overall, I'll just go from 1980 on. I've been through a lot of transitions in America. I've seen, what Ronald Reagan was trying to project and then other subsequent presidents. I think we go through phases of highs and lows. Right now, on a personal level, I'm thankful because I have one job with unlimited overtime. And as a parent, I can assert myself and pay high rent and still manage to pay about $2,000 in bills a month and be a survivor. And I don't have a lot of upheaval in my life. You know, like I'm not doing anything out of the realm of God, like sinning. Like, you know, I don't fornicate. I don't gamble anymore. I just try to stay on the path. And it seems when I do that God allows me to prosper in this country. But on the other hand, I would say I'm rather cynical, not just because of Donald Trump, but I'm cynical about the way that our coexistent Democratic and Republican parties treat and behave and act towards each other. However, I did see a highlight on the news today when each party in the congressional, Obama showed up in Congress, you know, he's going to be done in 2 weeks. He showed up to advocate one more time for Obamacare, and I saw that each side was advocating for what their personal stance was, including Paul Ryan, who said we're not just going to drop the ball, like we're not just going to eliminate Obamacare without having a transition program. On the same hand, I saw Nancy Pelosi making a strong case about the fine details of Obamacare and what needs to be strengthened or maintained versus what needs to be possibly dropped if it is dropped. So in those instances, when I see people advocating their ideological thrust, I think it's a positive thing because they're still kind of like playing to the center core of what their belief system is. So I think America is a transient place, just like the rest of the world. And every day we get fed different tidbits and facts about things that are disturbing and positive. And just like the 39 people who died in Turkey this last week in a bombing, one was a 19-year-old from Israel who had never left the country before, and her parents didn't want her to go, and she was killed. And so we're a number of other young people from around the world, whether they were from Turkey or Saudi Arabia, they were all there trying to celebrate the new year and their lives were taken from them. So I think it doesn't matter if I live in the United States or somewhere else, we're living in sober times where it's like that verse in the Bible where it says the devil's prowling around ready to capture somebody. So if you're not on guard, you're going to be swallowed up. And I try to stay on my A game because I know at any time that something major could really overtake us. Does that answer your question? Oh, you're off mute. You somehow landed in mute again. Does that answer your question, John?
Yeah, so you're basically hanging in there. You're trying to keep the faith.
I'm trying to survive. I've been in the survival mode since I gave birth to my son, which was 1998. Now I'm kind of, I guess you could say that I'm in a renaissance phase because I don't have a lot of external responsibilities outside of getting the work and back. And I don't have
right.
to baby and pamper Lauren every day. So I have time to devote new energies to new projects. Like I'm thinking of starting a newspaper up here, but I also might be moving back to LA in 6 months. So I'm in a phase where I have to figure out my life. But basically, I do think, like I said, on an international level, even in the HuffPost article I read before you got on the air, that things are really, there's a lot of crises around the world right now. And America has to try to find out where they can fit in. Like, they can't just jump in and try to find a military solution to everything. They're going to have to use both diplomatic and defense mechanisms to try to solve problems. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no. I think diplomatic is nice. I think historically, that's not the ultimate. In other words, if we didn't have nukes, if we didn't have a strong military, we could talk all we want. No one would listen. It's only because we have such strength. Like, no one listens to Mexico. No one listens to Uganda. You know, no one listens to Bolivia. How come? They just don't have the might. You know, here comes Panama. Back up. It's like, no. But no, here comes Russia. Here comes China. Here comes America. We have the big sticks. So I think, unfortunately, we are in an environment where, and it's always been that way, the Roman Empire. Now, what's interesting is the Roman Empire came and went. Christianity continued beyond that. So I think you have to have a faith system. What I do like about Donald Trump is before it was popular, he said, you know what? I believe in the Bible, whether he reads it or not. He said, evangelical Christians, he said, I got your back. I'm on your side. Like, you don't have to be afraid. Stand up. In this environment, this politically correct environment.
I have a scenario to throw at you, and I want to test you.
Go for it.
Okay, remember 5 years ago in 2011 when 11 Middle East nations fell? So there was President Mubarak in Egypt was under the American thumb for 30 years. He was pretty much a puppet regime leader, but not that many Egyptians died. They had a so-so pretty good economy. You know, like there was periods of time in Egypt where there was crises, but it ran pretty smoothly under this puppet minister. Then the big watershed came and all those people stood in that Egyptian square for months on end. And they ended up removing Mubarak, putting him on trial, putting a new guy in. A bunch of people died. And then the region was destabilized. So my question to you is, was the Egyptians better off with an American-run puppet regime? Or were they better off with self-determination and bloodshed?
I think culture, Christianity or let's say an American-based system of having capitalism and having a democratic process, having a democratic republic. When you impose that on people that don't believe in it, or that's not their roots, it's not their value system. Let's say they're Muslim, so they're going to go to their roots, and that's not going to line up with what we practice. So I think it's, in a way, it's certain incompatible. You know, it's kind of like it's raising a child for failure. You're programmed to fail is what I call it. I'll give you an example. I have friends in Hispanic culture, and I tell them, hey, these are kids in church, because we have an American church, we have a Spanish church. So we have different cultures. We have a Korean, we also have Chinese, and so forth. So the kids from the Hispanic culture in general, you know, like the 16 to 25-year-old kids, I rub shoulders with them, and I'll say, hey, how's it going? Do you have a car yet? And they go, well, no, not really. Well, why not? Well, I haven't had any driver education classes. Okay. Do you have a bank account? Well, not really. Our parents get money, and they put an account for me. Do you have your own credit card? Do you know how to balance your checkbook? Do you know how to do this and do that? Do you have a job skill? Are you taking classes to prepare you to work in the adult world? And they're like, I haven't thought about it. Like, this is a cultural thing. And I tell them, let me tell you something, kid. You're being programmed to fail. I may be the first person to not.
Can I interrupt you a second? I'm not really sure. Well, first of all, Don's on the line, but I understand. I kind of understand where you're going with the scenario, and I'll let you explain. But Egypt used to be a center for intellectual learning. It was a Christian nation until the 7th century. And Alexandria was a huge center for a philosophical haven for people like studying Plato and stuff like that. And it didn't become fully Islamic until after the 8th century. But there's still a 10% Orthodox Christians there and other Christians, and it's 90% Muslim. So where it's centered in Africa, it was a place where a lot of things happened. For example, there was the Suez Crisis with British there. So England and a lot of European countries were heavily involved in Egypt through the 50s and 60s with power negotiation and power brokering with the Suez Canal and stuff. But I'll let Don in a minute, but could you re-explain where you were going with this youth concept?
Right. So when I start telling these kids, hey, you should do this and you should do that, some of them start to do it, then they have a little resistance from their folks. Not a lot, not like I'm the Antichrist, but they're more like, oh, you don't have to worry about this or that. Or or you know, I don't want the kids to grow up saying, oh man, your parents are evil or they're screwing you. What I tell them is, kid, listen, I just want to let you know, when you turn 18, you're an adult, you're responsible for your life. I don't know if anyone's told you that. It's not going to be mommy or daddy if you rob a bank, if you have an accident, if you get sued. It's your life. So take charge of it. Prepare for that. So I think when we go into other countries and their value system, their tradition, their religion is not ours, and then we try to just force our way, you know, and just impose it on them, they're programmed to fail. Like, we have to understand their culture and what they're about. And then if as a collective they say, oh, we like your ideals, we like Christianity, we like, and there's some countries that have bought into what we do, that's fine. But it usually starts with the leadership, the religious leaders, the hierarchy. And if you don't have that support, yeah, you can barrel down on someone, but eventually they're going to rebel or they're going to go to their roots. And you know, like if someone tries to impose Islam on me, I'll listen. But in my heart, I'm going to rebel, you know, or same thing with being a Buddhist.
Well,
so
what I was trying to say is that in 2011, there was a watershed of 10 or 11 nations in the Middle East that after 30 or 40 years of a certain restrictive government where they weren't allowed to express themselves, all of a sudden through social media, places like Tunisia, Egypt, and other places had this watershed. And they expressed their opinions, and many people died because of it. But what we're relating this to the bigger concept of what America's role is in the world in the next 4 years, which we haven't really sorted out. So with that, I'm going to bring Don in. Good evening, Don. Don Gallimore, are you with us? John Gallimore. Okay, John, go ahead with your ideology. He's not talking.
Ah, yes, yeah, sometimes more idiot than ology. But I do think we have to use caution when we go into places and we disrupt the nature of things. It's just like with when you go and you deal with you go in a different culture. You go into a different room where they're speaking Korean and you try to bust things up. You have to learn Korean. You know, you have to learn Spanish to communicate, or you have to have someone to interpret for you. So I think when we do go into these countries, we need this.
John's called up. Are you there, Don? Are you there, Don? Because I'm getting pissed off. Okay, I'm going to hang Don up. Hi, John. Just go ahead and continue.
Yes, technology is failing us. But what I was going to say is, to be successful in another culture, it really takes two or three generations or more, but at least a generation or two, because you're going to have the grandparents. They're probably not going to change unless they're fed up. You know, unless they're rebels or they're quiet dissidents that have been secretly longing for a change. The parents, they're strong in their way. Usually when a person hits 20 and they make decisions about their life, like I'm going to be an atheist or I'm going to be a capitalist to make a lot of money or I'm going to be a rock and roll, whatever, that person probably isn't going to change course for 5, 10, 20 years until they hit a wall. You know, maybe that rocker when he's 30, 35 goes, oh, I'm tired. Most of these rockers that were, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, by the time they hit 35 or 40, they have to change or they'll die. You know, they go, oh, I need to go to rehab or I need to change the way I can't. I have so many sexual diseases or I've got all these divorces and problems. I need to change the way I think. And same thing with any of that. So the people that are 35 to 45 in these cultures with their kids, they've already committed to being a Muslim or to being a socialist or to being, submitting to a dictator like Saddam Hussein. They're wired to do that. And then the kids, they're half, you know, the teens and all that, they're halfway wired into it too. And when they get to college, they're kind of questioning, and you probably changed a lot of things. I changed a lot of things. You know, when you hit that 18 to 22 mark, you're deciding for yourself, do I carry on all this baggage from my folks? Do I pick and choose? Or do I just go my own way? And then I think it's just that third or fourth generation. It's those, you know, 1 to 10 year olds. Now, those are the minds. You know, Hitler knew that. It's like communists know that. It's like, get the children. Get the mothers, and I will have their children. And that's where the culture, I think that's where socialism and other things have succeeded, is they've gone after the women, the feminists, and they impose those values in the kids. The kids grow up with that value system, and it's a different way of thinking than before.
I agree with 90% of what you said. You know, I feel like I lost Lauren at around age 13 or 14 because he made a conscious decision not to follow God. And after that, he just got consumed with worldly pleasures, including playing Xbox 14 hours a day. And after that, there was nothing I could do about it. But can I mention something before we? I already hung up on Don. Well, here he is again. But let me just pull him in a minute to see if he's coherent. Hi, Don. We hung up on you earlier because you didn't talk.
We didn't hang up on me. You hung up on me. But that's all right.
I hung up on you because you did not talk.
Because I didn't know how to talk. I put you with the Uber app and then I couldn't get it back. I couldn't get you back. So
it's okay. I've never hung up on you in the 2 years that you've been on this show. And John keeps. We only have 11 minutes of the show left in real time, but I do want to mention one thing. I'm sorry to keep you on. I want to mention something because John and I were talking about the future role of U.S. foreign policy and what hotspots we should approach and which ones we should leave alone. But I was talking to John about different. He was talking about American inventions and how Americans have invented so much. Well, I wanted to give John an example of Poland. Because Poland has, in the last 5 years, they've had a huge computer industry. And right now, their Polish gaming industry is worth an estimated $280 million. They have this one hot game called The Witcher. It's an iconic role-playing game based on a uniquely Polish series of fantasy novels. And they've done a lot of research and development and sent a lot of people to our own Silicon Valley to work. So I do think, okay, now Don's call dropped and John's back in. But, John, I have you back off mute. I was talking about how Poland has a new $280 million industry a year in gaming and how they've sent people over to our own Silicon Valley in Northern California because a lot of Americans are ill-equipped to run the computer industry. We do have a lot of Northern Europeans in the Silicon Valley. So that goes back to an earlier point I was trying to make. Are you there, John?
Oh, yeah. I was listening to your point. And so, yeah, you know, I think as the technology goes across the world, other countries grab onto it. And that, you know, come to it.
Don, you're on the air too, so don't babble randomly to strangers. Don Gallimore. Don Gallimore. This is the most technologically defunct radio show in the business. We need the Polish. Don Gallimore. Earth to Don Gallimore. John,
yes,
you say
Don
something.
Gallimore. Yes. Go ahead. I'm just going to say
stop
hi.
Shuffling. stop shuffling your dinner dishes and get on the goddamn air.
I would never do that. Hold on for a second.
Well, now I blew my Christian witness, John.
Yes, yeah. You did. You blew it all. Just one word.
The lightning's going to strike.
I know.
Dear God, please forgive me for saying... Please forgive me for saying blank, blank on the air.
Right. Even though you feel like saying it in real life right now, especially. All right.
Okay, I'm going to... Go ahead, John. Could you say something?
Yes, I'm saying I'm in beautiful, sunny, snowy Reno, Nevada, and I love it here, and wouldn't trade it for the world. You guys better come on down and join us. We're getting ready to have a fantastic ski season and all kinds of other things that are going on in this next year here in beautiful, radiation city, Nevada.
Yeah, John, they got snow there today.
And we're going to have snow for the next 5 days.
Well, lucky you. That's not something I really admire, given the fact that it's 0 degrees in Minnesota right now.
Yep, you bet. And for the most part, I wouldn't mind being in Minnesota either. That's where you cuddle up and make sure that you stay warm.
What kind of crack are you smoking? John, are you there tonight?
Who, me?
I mean,
yeah,
John, are you saying you want to cuddle up with a Scandinavian?
Wow.
Hey, John, I could cuddle up with worse now, couldn't I?
Well, I think you're well ahead of us all in that department, Don.
I'll believe I know.
I should give Don kudos. Don helped me earlier tonight. I had a meltdown, John.
Wow.
I went to McDonald's and Lauren wasn't there and I cried and I had a mother attack and I went to his house with his 5 roommates and cried on the doorstep.
Cried the moon. Just kept crying.
And I probably embarrassed him.
Well, yeah. That probably explains your earlier anti-American socialist rant.
Probably does.
I didn't have an anti-American rant. You went into an info commercial about Americans' great inventions. Well, I was trying to explain to you that.
I don't know if Don heard the beginning, but kind of Jane was going on how America, you know, maybe should have a more of a relaxed stance on the planet and not try to influence things, just kind of be involved but not overly involved. And I was just explaining just kind of from my viewpoint that we're just an incredible country, you know, that has done stuff that no one else has or maybe ever will do as far as contributing inventions, you know, automobile, radio, planes, TVs, computers. I mean, just our influence has just, I think, just lapped everyone incredibly. I think a lot of it is because we are free thinkers. We have liberty. We have the ability, capitalism. We have the ability to pursue our dreams. But I also told her that I think our downfall has been when we've abandoned the spiritual principles that are underneath all of that, that you begin to get consumed with greed and selfishness and manipulating and murder and a lot of dark things come out.
I didn't say that.
I'm saying that I think where people like you question America's involvement is because we let these other darker vices take control because spiritually we've disconnected. And I mentioned that a lot of that came out of the 60s where we outlawed God in the school. In the 70s, we had a lot of feminism rise up, and suddenly women were putting the values in kids that were different than what I grew up with. And culturally, we've slipped away from that. We're not taking our kids to church. We don't believe in God. We talk about it, but we really don't practice it. And I think that's where our decline has begun. And that's kind of one of the reasons I'm excited about Trump. You know, whether right or wrong, whether he's evil or not, he's saying, I've got your back if you're an evangelical. I believe in the Bible, whether he reads it or not. He doesn't care if people are going to badmouth him for it. And I don't see that among our public leaders. You know, they cower down to what's politically correct. I pray for him.
Okay, can you guys hear me okay? Because I switched off speaker. Can you hear me?
It was clear before.
I'm back on speaker. I feel like John went Noah's dive too far into domestic, America's domestic agenda and vision, and didn't capitulate properly what our foreign policy initiatives or our contribution in the world on an economic worldwide scale and things having to do with, you know, cooperative global markets. Because nothing's going to be achieved on a worldwide level unity-wise unless we can avoid war and get into some type of initiative that's going to help all countries. Go ahead, Don. Don, John's call dropped now, so if you don't say something, I'm going to end the show. Okay, I'm going to play a song now. I'm trying to find a song that we haven't played lately. Okay, Don doesn't talk anymore. He's on mute, so here we go. Dropping your call, Don. I'm playing the song and then the show is over.
Stay up late at night. Am I someone?
I have one last comment from the Henry Kissinger book. We did have a lot of technical problems tonight, and I apologize to my listening audience. Both George Bush and Bill Clinton spoke of a new world order as if it were just around the corner. In fact, it is still in a period of gestation, and its final form will not be visible until well into the next century. Part extension of the past, part unprecedented, the new world order, like those which it succeeds, will emerge as an answer to three questions. What are the basic units of international order? What are their means of interacting? What are the goals on behalf of which they interact? First of all, since Henry Kissinger wrote this book 25 to 30 years ago, the basic units of international order have changed dramatically. There's the existence now of the non-state terrorist actors and their giant impact on the world. In other words, their borderless, ideological, religious regimes that act within their own non-geographic entity and damage and penetrate other countries and nations, such as Syria, the Nineveh plains between Syria and Iraq, places like Mosul and northern Iraq. So all that has changed, and we'll tackle that on our next episode. Thank you for listening.